Well, hey, I want to talk a little bit this morning. We're in this teaching series called Old Testament Characters. We're examining the lives of certain people and how they lived life in the Old Testament, which is the time way before Jesus. And the reason we're doing that is because really the Bible is God's story, but how he interacted with people in the midst of that story, it leads us into places where we can learn stuff. And so we want to do that to get a window into ourselves, to get a window into what God's story really is like and what the impact that has on us today. So today, we're going to be looking at, oh, come on, it's got to be working. All right. Look at this guy named Elijah. Now, I got to give you a little backstory today because we're going to be focusing on a chapter in 1 Kings. So if you're in your Bibles, that's where you can look. And I got to give you some background because Elijah was one of the most powerful prophets in Israel. So when they talk in Israel about the prophets, Elijah was one of the most powerful, one of the most famous prophets. He operated in Israel, this northern Israel, and he did it primarily during the reign of a guy named Ahab. And Ahab was a bad king. Just, he was wicked. He wanted nothing to do with God. He married this Phoenician bride named Jezebel, brought her in from another country, another culture. She brought all her gods with him. She hated Yahweh, didn't want anything to do with it, tried to exterminate Yahweh worship within the country. And so Israel started to walk away from God. And so what God did was he sent a 3.5-year drought through Elijah. Elijah went to the king and said, look, you know, Israel's not listening. It's not going to rain for 3.5 years. I mean, that is an incredible long time. So there's this horrible drought. The king and the queen, they blame Elijah, right? Instead of taking any ownership, but they just blame him. And so for 3.5 years, they have this massive drought. It's wrecking the country. And finally, God tells Elijah the drought's going to end, but it's going to end spectacularly. There you go. It's not my way now. It's going to end spectacular. And so if you read this, it's in 1 Kings 18. It's this amazing story, and I can't go into it in detail because we don't have time. But essentially, he calls a whole, like, just thousands of people together from Israel onto the top of Mount Carmel. He gets them to bring all the prophets of Baal, which was their main worship god. And he says, we're going to have a contest. You build an altar. We'll build an altar. I'll build an altar. And then you go first. You call onto Baal and see if he'll send down fire from heaven to devour your offering. And then I'll do the same. And whichever one sends fire, that's the real god. And so there's this whole story in the prophet Baal. They go crazy, and they're dancing around, they're jumping, they're cutting themselves, they're doing all this stuff. Nothing happens. Elijah makes fun of them. Finally, the better part of a day goes by. He says, okay, enough, enough. And he tells the people, okay, let's soak it. He pours water on it. He digs a trench. He soaks it. So, I mean, there's no way this could accidentally fire. And then he prays one prayer. God, show them who you are. And boom, fire comes down, burns the offering, burns the stones, evaporates the water. It's this amazing thing. All the people are like, oh, my goodness, this is God. And so Elijah says, yeah, it is. See all those 400 prophets of Baal? They need to die. So they capture them. They kill them all. And then God ends the drought. This amazing fashion. It's this mountaintop experience. And that's where we're going to pick up the story. Now, Ahab told Jezebel everything Elijah had done, and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah to say, may the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like one of them. In other words, you're dead. Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. And when he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there while he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness. And he came to a broom bush and he sat down under it and he prayed that he might die. I've had enough, Lord, he said. Take my life. I'm no better than any of my ancestors. And then he lay down under the bush and fell asleep. Let me ask you something. Have you ever been there? You know, that place where you're like, oh, I'm just so tired of this. I can't believe it. This is just, it's so awful. You know that where you felt disillusioned and you were discouraged and you thought, what's the point of all this anyway? Now, most of us have either been there, are there, or we will be there at some point. It's life, right? And what happens in those spots, these valleys, these bottom places, it can affect everything in our lives. It can affect ourselves. It affects our relationships with others, with God, with other. And the question that came to mind is, okay, so when that happens, because we're all either there or going to be there or have been there, what do we do? Like, how do we respond? How do we act when we get into one of those valley places in our lives? So from this story, I want to look at three things. I want to look at what the valley looks like, what happens in the valley. I want to look at how God deals with us when we're in the midst of the valley, and what does that do for how we respond, okay? That's kind of how I'm going to unpack the story as we go through this morning. So let's read the rest of the story. It's a little bit long, but I want to read it all at once before we unpack it. So here's how the story continues. Here's how the account continues. So Elijah's asleep. He's under a bush trying to get some shade in the desert. And all at once, an angel touched him and said, "Get up, eat." And he looked around, and there by his head was some bread baked over hot coals, fresh bread, and a jar of water. So he ate and drank and then lay down again, fell back asleep. The angel of the Lord came back to him a second time and touched him and said, "Get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you." So he got up and he ate and he drank. And strengthened by that food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights until he reached Horeb, the mountain of God. There he went into a cave and he spent the night. And the word of the Lord came to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he replied, "I've been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant. They've torn down your altars. They put your prophets to death with the sword. I'm the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me too." And the Lord said, "Well, go stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." And then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake came a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire came a gentle whisper. And when Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face. He went out and he stood at the mouth of the cave. And then a voice said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he replied, "I've been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, torn down your altars, and put your prophets to death through the sword. I am the only one left, and now they are trying to kill me too." Actually, we're going to come back to this here. I'm going to skip that part for now. Utterly fascinating story. Now, when you read something like this, you have to understand that the valleys that we go into are normal. You understand that? These are not weird things. They're not things that, like, I can't believe this happened, right? In fact, if you're on a mountaintop where you have this amazing experience like Elijah did, what's the only direction you can go? Down, right? If you were on the mountains and you stayed on the mountains, it wouldn't be a mountain. It would be a plateau. But that's not how life works. Life has ups and downs. Valleys are normal. Valleys happen. We act like we would like life to be one continuous mountaintop. And some of you are like, "Look, I don't even need a mountaintop. I just don't want to go that low. Like, just make it a little valley. Like, I don't need it all." But that's what we want. And so what happens is Elijah is exhausted in this process. He's just gone through this amazing event, this mountain. And literally, it was a mountaintop experience. It happened on a mountain. And it's wiped him out. And he is hungry. He is tired. He is suicidal. He is in a low place physically. And I find it interesting in this story that before God does anything else, he meets Elijah's physical needs. He's like, "Okay, you are down in the valley, Elijah. You are not going to have a proper perspective on anything. Just because, I mean, you can't even see past where you're at. So you know what? Before we have any conversation, before we do anything, Elijah, sleep. Go ahead. And when you're done sleeping, I have heavenly baked bread, which has to be amazing, right? I mean, if I get up tomorrow morning and an angel's put a loaf of fresh bread on the counter, I mean, woo, that's going to be good, right? And then he goes to sleep and he gets it again, right? So God is saying, "Look, you need to sleep because you're exhausted. You need to eat because you're hungry. Your body is, I mean, everything is falling apart. That's why the valley feels so bad to you." And so when you're in a valley, remember that. Because while a valley is not typically just physical, physicality has a component in the valley. And until you deal with that, you can't do anything. You lose all perspective. But once those issues are taken together, Elijah travels all the way to something, and here we say it's called Mount Horeb. Now, for those of you that are not familiar, that mountain has another name. It's also known as Mount Sinai. Do you guys remember what happened at Mount Sinai? Mount Sinai is where Moses saw God in the burning bush. Mount Sinai is where Moses climbed to the top and God handed him the Ten Commandments and the law. for Israel. Mount Sinai was a place where God appeared in power and thunder and lightning, where the Israelites said, we don't even get to touch the mountain, because if we touch the base of the mountain, we're going to die. This was the place where Moses met with God, came down, his face glowed so people couldn't even look at him. This was the place that Elijah ends up. But he's still in the valley himself. Because here's the thing. Here's the first thing. You want to take a look. Let's answer the first question. What's the valley like? It's easy to lose perspective in the valley. When we are in the valleys of life, we lose perspective. I love this interaction between Elijah and God. Right? Listen to Elijah's complaint. Because he goes in this cave. He spends the night. And God says, okay, Elijah, what are you doing here? Not physically here. But why are you here? What's going on? Listen to Elijah's complaint. I have been zealous for God. I'm doing my job. You called me to be a prophet. I am doing it. I am doing it well. I'm in with everything I've got. I am pouring myself out for this, God. But Israelites, those people have rejected your covenant. In other words, they don't pay attention. They're not living the way they're supposed to live. In fact, they tear down your altars. They want nothing to do with what I'm saying. They're putting the people like me to death. They're killing them. I'm the only one left. And now they're trying to kill me too. I would love to know the tone of voice that Elijah had right here. Was he whiny? Was he deflated? What was going on? The words, though, kind of give us three things. Because here's three things that will happen every single time you are in the valley. These are the temptations you'll be faced with whenever you're trying to work your way through those low points in your life. Here's what happened. Elijah had an inflated sense of himself. Because look what he says. I am very zealous. He says, God, I'm doing all the right things. I'm trying hard. I'm doing more than anybody else. I'm living the right way. I'm following the rules. I'm following you. I'm accomplishing stuff. And it is not turning out the way it's supposed to. There's a pride here. Now, most of us would say, well, that's not me. When I'm in the valley, I'm not prideful. I just feel lousy. I don't go to God and say I'm doing all these things. Do you know what? Yes, you are. Because do you know what the essence of the valley is? Is a focus on me, which is the very definition of a prideful sense and an inflated view of ourselves. And it usually goes one way. We get very indignant, like just like Elijah. We say, look, I'm doing everything. I'm living the right way. Everybody else is doing whatever they want, however they want. Their lives are amazing. I'm following you, God, and my life sucks. What is wrong with you, right? We go down that path, or, oh, I guess I deserve it. I'm such a bad person. Yeah, it makes sense. I'm in the valley. God's just punishing me because I'm really not such a very good person. In both cases, we're focused exclusively on us. Anytime you're in the valley, that's the temptation, is to put the focus on the thing here. That's what Elijah does. But then he does a second thing. He compares. You know who he says the problem is right here? Them. God, it's the Israelites. They're not paying attention. I mean, goodness, they're not following the covenant. They're tearing down altars. They're killing prophets. Look at all those people, God. Look what they're doing. And I'm telling you, when we get in the valley, the first thing we do is we compare ourselves to other people or situations. You can see Elijah saying, look, I just showed them on the top of a mountain, fire from heaven. They're still not following you. In fact, they only followed you as long as it took Ahab to run home and tattle to Jezebel. And yet we do this exact same thing all the time. We're in the valley. We begin to look at everybody else. And we compare our lives to their lives. We compare our situation to their situation. We compare how we behave to how they behave. And we begin to draw all these lines. And we say, God, it's not fair. We go to comparison so easily in the valley. But then, here's the third thing. Elijah isolated himself. What does he say at the end of his complaint? I'm the only one left. There's nobody else like this. It's just me. Woe is me. He'd become irrationally fearful because Jezebel's trying to kill him. And he's saying, I'm literally the only person in this entire country that serves you, God. Now, did you read in this? Did you notice in this in the story? I find this utterly fascinating. He's complaining about being alone. Did you notice what he did? Because if you read a little early, it says he traveled to a certain point and then told his servant, you stay behind, I'm going to go by myself. And I used to read that thing, it's just a servant. No, it probably wasn't a servant. It was almost, in all likelihood, an apprentice. Someone who served with him, who watched what he did. Someone who was intimately involved in his life. And Elijah says, yeah, I need to go by myself. When we are in the valley, our tendency, especially if we're introverted, but even for extroverts, is to say, I want to be by myself. I don't want to talk to anybody else. Nobody else cares. And so what we do is we isolate ourselves and then complain to God that nobody cares about us. You ever done that? Oh, nobody ever calls me. I never get to go out with anybody. No one ever invites me over for dinner. No one cares. No one's called me. No one's texted me. And the question is, have you texted or called anybody? Well, no, but they should know better and they should call me, right? When we're in the valley, we want to isolate ourselves from people. When we isolate ourselves from God, it's just never helpful. So, understand, this is the valley. These are the dangers that we face because we lose perspective on what's really going on in the world and in life. Elijah lost his perspective. He focused on, when this happens, we focus on ourselves. We view other people wrongly. We dismiss good news. We minimize victories. We maximize problems and defeats. And there's a complete loss of perspective. So if we want to deal well with our time in the valley, we have to begin to actually believe that our perspective might not be the right one. Even if we say, well, I don't even know how to get out of that, that's okay. We have to start with this, you know what? All these things I'm telling myself may not be completely true. But that's just the beginning. That kind of opens the door for what happens. Because the next question is, what does God do in the valley? And I find the next sequence utterly fascinating. So God tells Elijah, go stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord. The Lord's going to pass by. And then he said, I want you to pay attention, Elijah. And he brings this hurricane force wind. I mean, so strong, it's really ripping rocks apart. Right? So think of the worst storms you've been in New Jersey where trees are being knocked over. Like, this is amped up past that. I mean, it's crazy powerful. But he doesn't get any sense of God's presence. Then he brings an earthquake. You know, the whole world's shaking around him. Remember, he's in a cave. It's not a pleasant thing. And then there's fire just sweeping across the mountain. Now, every one of these things, wind, earthquake, fire, throughout the entire Old Testament are all symbols of God's presence and his power, and often his judgment. They come. You read this. You can see it all through the Psalms, and they talk about the earth shaking and quaking, and God is, I mean, he appeared to Moses in a bush on fire. So fire, I mean, these were common themes, so Elijah's well aware of them, but we're told that he doesn't experience anything of God in any of them. And then God whispers, and Elijah falls apart. And what I find even more curious is that God asks Elijah the exact same question twice. Do you notice that? He started and said, why are you here, Elijah? Elijah gives his complaint. God says, okay, go stand on the mountain. He has all these amazing things. He's not in any of them. Then he whispers. And then he says to Elijah, Elijah, why are you here? And I thought, why would he do this twice? Why didn't he just ask the question, hear the complaint, and give the answer? He didn't do that. So there's something that God is trying to teach Elijah in the midst of this before he asks him the question the second time. Why did he feel the need to do all these things? And I think it's for a very, very strategic and key reason. And it's the same thing that he does when we're in the valley. And it's simply this. He is always, always, always looking in the valley to restore us back into relationship with him. Because remember, one of the characteristics of the valley is isolation and having a loss of perspective. God wants to restore that. You know, it's interesting. Not only were those phenomena usually symbolic of God's presence, but he's doing it on the very mountain where he used those very things to show Moses that he was God. And Elijah knew all these stories. He knew where he was. There's some people that say, if you read the original Hebrew, when it says he's in a cave, in our translation it says he went into a cave or the cave, or a cave. A lot of people say you can translate the cave. And a lot of people think it's the exact same cave that God put Moses when he sheltered him when God wanted to see his face. And he says, I'm going to walk by and you can see my backside. God's glory and his presence. So Elijah knew all this stuff. He understood it. And Elijah, remember, he had just had an experience where he stood on a mountaintop in front of hundreds, if not thousands of people, and prayed. His whole life was on the line, and God sent fire from heaven. It was powerful and it was amazing, but the results were disappointing. Because he thought, after all this, this entire nation should turn back to Jesus. Come back to God. Come back to Yahweh. And they did not. In fact, the people recognized who God was, and that lasted as long as it took Ahab to go home and tattletale to his wife. See, what often triggers a valley experience is that our expectations of what we think should be are not met. So what God is doing with Elijah is he's adjusting Elijah's expectations of God. Elijah had all these expectations. This is what, I mean, God, this is who you are. You come in power. You just came in power. You showed everybody this is how they should respond. They didn't. God, what are you doing? We have this picture in our heads. This is often what triggers the valley because we think we know how God should act and how life should turn out. See, Elijah thought that the primary means of reaching people was through dramatic and spectacular ways, and he expected God to work a certain way in a certain time, and it just wasn't working out. And God says, whoa. You need to adjust your expectations. You think that this is the only way I work in power? No. It's way bigger than that. It's way better than that. And so he parades all his power in front of Elijah and says, see, I'm not there. You think that's how I am? No. And then he speaks. And I wonder, I don't know if you remember that storm that came through. I don't know, was it 5-6 years ago now? Remember that storm came through that blew through and knocked all the trees down? It was just crazy. Have you ever walked outside right after a storm and felt how quiet it is? And I wonder for Elijah, like the deafening sounds of an earthquake. You hear people talk about this in storms all the time. The tornadoes sound like trains and freight trains. And he's got this wind. He's got the earthquake. There's fire that's just roaring. And then all of a sudden, it's gone. And it is dead quiet. And he hears a whisper. So very quiet. And he is undone in a way that the power demonstration could never do. Because here's what God was doing. He said, look, your expectations are off. You need to put your eyes back on me. You've lost perspective. All you're seeing is all the stuff around you that you're not even seeing correctly, and you're missing me. And after his display, he asks Elijah the same question. And of course, my mind thinks, how did he ask the question? Your tone of voice completely changes this question. What are you doing here, Elijah? Right? That's how we might ask our kids something if we're irritated, right? You wonder, first time he shows up, what are you doing here, Elijah? Really? Is that what it is? I don't think so. Especially the second time. I think it might have been more neutral the first time. But after all that happens and he's speaking the still small voice, I feel like God was reaching in compassion saying, Elijah, what are you doing here? Talk to me. What's interesting is that Elijah's answer doesn't change. And I wonder if the reason God is asking this question, not because he wanted to know, like, I don't need to know, Elijah, why you're here, but do you know why you're here? I'm God. It's just like when he called out Adam and Eve, where are you in the garden? It's like, he's not looking for information. He's saying, I know why you're here, but do you know why you're here? And Elijah's answer reveals a lot. He says, Elijah, I don't just speak through mountaintop experiences. I don't just speak through amazing healings like we heard this morning. I don't just speak through these unbelievable things. Sometimes I just want to talk. And there's something very significant about a whisper. Do you know a whisper is a very intimate form of communication? It's not something you do with a stranger across a room. A whisper is what you do when you're sitting side by side and it's quiet and you talk softly to somebody that you care about. It's what you guys do in here when you don't think I'm looking. Right? You whisper to each other. But I mean, you know what that is? Like, that's whisper. Whisper is, it's intimate, it's quiet, it's between two people. God is telling Elijah, you just need to stand still and listen to me. And we're told Elijah pulls his cloak over his face. It kind of seems odd to us, but what it is an act of worship and reverence. Because when he heard that quiet voice, he was undone. He's like, I can't, I'm in God's presence, and he pulls his cloak over his face, saying, I can't look at the face of God. You know, when we're in the midst of our valleys, we need to trust a little bit less in what we see God doing and a little bit more in who God is. Because what we want is the next mountaintop experience to get us out of the valley. All right? I'm going to white-knuckle it through this valley until I get to this part over here. And then it'll all be good again till the next valley. And I feel like God in the middle of it is saying, no. When you're in the valley, your perspective is warped. That's when I want to turn you back this way to me. Because he's in the valley. He's speaking in the valley. In the midst of them, he's inviting us in to worship. It's the number one tool you have in the valley is to worship. To say, God, you're amazing. This is who you are. I want to experience you. Because he cares deeply and he wants us to hear his voice. I find it interesting that it's only after all this that he even addresses Elijah's complaint. And what's interesting, he actually doesn't address his complaint at all. He doesn't say, okay, now let me go through your complaints point by point and explain how your perspective is messed up. He actually doesn't compliment him on what he had done well. He doesn't berate him for anything that he has misbelieved. He doesn't do any of that. He doesn't deal with him that way. He doesn't comfort him. What he does is affirm his presence and his relationship. Okay, catch the order. He says, I'm going to affirm who I am, that we actually have this relationship, that your eyes need to be focused on me. And then he goes immediately to the third thing, which is, I'm going to reappoint you to service and purpose. This is how he responded. The Lord said to him, go back the way you came. In other words, go back home. And go to the desert of Damascus, and when you get there, anoint Hazael, king over Aram. By the way, that doesn't mean anything to us, except it's crazy because he's telling an Israelite prophet to go to a foreign country, to a foreign person, and anoint them king. And not only that, that king that he's going to anoint king destroys Israel, the generation after Elijah. In such a way that it made the next prophets weep because how he killed women and children in Israel. That's his task. I want you to go do this, Elijah. Oh, and by the way, I want you to anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, king over Israel, which basically means I want you to start an insurrection because Ahab's still alive. I want you to go appoint this guy to be king. Okay? And then I want you to anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat, to succeed you as the prophet. There you go. Tripartite. I want you to anoint a new king from another country. I want you to anoint a new king in Israel, and I want you to anoint your successor, the guy that you're training up to follow you so that he'll take your place. And by the way, Elijah, Jehu will put to death anybody who escapes the sword of Hazael, and Elisha will put to death anybody who escapes the sword of Jehu. Judgment is coming. You don't think I'm involved and that I'm active? I am. And only after all that does he say, oh, yeah, and by the way, you're not by yourself. There's 7,000 people in this country who have not bowed down to Baal, and they're mine. So come on, Elijah, get with it. You have a purpose. And I appointed you before. I am reappointing you. I'm saying you can do this because you have me. This isn't because of the results of your life or the results of the things you do. That's not what drives this. What drives this is my presence speaking to you. Now go, get it done. See, in the valley, the temptation to check out and to run away from God and others is a huge one. That is not where we want to start working harder. We're leaning into what God has for us. That's when we say, oh, I need a break. I can't do this. I got to work through my stuff, then I'll engage again. Now. You know, one of the things that I have had to wrestle with the most as I considered moving on from hope over the last year was that I did not want it to be in response to a valley experience. I did not ever want to be running away from anything. So for a year, I wrestled with God and said, is that what's going on here? Because that's not what I want to do. Where are you leading? I want this to be in response to you saying, okay, Weldon, I am repurposing and re-giving you a new mission in a new direction, and I want you to go. Because I can do that. I don't want to do the other. And as we go through this season of transition, every single one of you is going to face that the same way to a different degree. Am I being re-challenged to re-up for purpose and mission? Or am I going to check out because things are different? They're not the same. I don't feel the way it did before. You know what? I'm just going to take a break from all this for a year or two. See, God has a purpose for every one of us, and our past experiences don't disqualify them from us. They don't let us sit back and do nothing. Instead, we need to listen to Him. So, when you're in the valley and you begin to lose perspective, take a pause and say, okay, God, what's going on here? I don't know if my perspective is right. It feels right to me because I'm in the middle of this, but maybe it's not right. Consider where you might be beginning to focus on yourself to the exclusion of other people and other things. And say, okay, I got to pay attention to what that's going on. Notice where you're beginning to compare yourself to others and that you're starting to isolate yourself. Begin to fight those impulses and say, no, I'm not going to do that. I want to accept God's invitation to regain a sense of who He is and how He deals with me. And then let Him, in that process, give you a renewed sense of purpose and a mission. Valleys are inevitable. Your life will not be a whole series of mountaintop experiences. You all know that. I'm just reminding you. Sometimes life is going to be valley-like. And in fact, if you think about it just strictly from a climbing perspective and use that metaphor, do you realize that you actually spend very little time on the mountaintop? Most of your time is either climbing towards the mountaintop, which is hard work, or descending out of the mountaintop into the valley. That's most of life. That's why this is so important. Because God's saying, look, in the midst of all of that, I'm there. You have mission, you have purpose, and I am speaking to you. So don't get discouraged. So I don't know what valley you're in, where you've been recently. It could be a work valley, it could be a financial valley, a relational valley, a health valley. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's connected to the current things that are in news, maybe not. It's okay. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to close with a song. But I want you to stand because there is a very famous psalm written by David about life in the valley. And I want to read that over us before we sing. So why don't you stand? Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures, and He leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. He guides me along the right paths for His name's sake. And even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for You are with me. And Your rod and Your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows in the valley. Surely Your goodness and Your love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever.